And now, your hosts for Life from the Pulpit, here's Nick Perez.
That's right, you can't stop it, you can only hope to contain it. The fastest half-hour podcast in the West, coming to you live and local from deep in the heart of the San Joaquin Valley, deep in the heart of Merced Church of Christ. I am your guide on this excursion into theology and other sundry matters, the voice of the valley, Nick Perez, offering up news and views you can use on Scripture and Society with a little help from my friends. Greetings, welcome to the program. Glad you tuned in. The last couple of episodes have been devoted to rehearsing the history of the Crusades. And I began this because of some of the comments made at the National Prayer Breakfast by President Obama. I don't know where that came from. But anyway, his view of history, well, it's kind of like Steve Jobs. Those who knew Steve Jobs, and I'm reading a biography on Steve Jobs, and that's why this is kind of fresh in my mind. Those who knew Steve Jobs said he had what they called a reality distortion field. The reality distortion field meant that typical, normal rules didn't apply to him. He could bend the truth in order to get his way, or even flat out lie in order to get what he needed from people. Reality distortion field. Well, I want to suggest that our president has a history revision field where facts about history and who did what, and they don't really apply to him. Or he can so spin the truth that he can make it say what he needs it to say in order to fit his agenda and push it forward. And in this case, for some reason, he feels it's necessary to defend the actions of radical Islamic terrorists by comparing their actions to those of the Crusaders nearly a millennium ago. Actions, by the way, that were performed on enemy combatants in wartime, mind you, not actions performed on non-combatants, including but not limited to women and children. It just seems to be a difference there, in my humble opinion. But really what this comes down to is that our fearless leader, President Barack Obama, fails to acknowledge that morally and philosophically, Christianity has always had the high ground when compared to every other religion on the face of the planet, Islam included. And I've already shared with you the facts concerning the history of... Listen, it's like... you remember the scene in Star Wars Episode 4 where Han Solo has met Obi-Wan Kenobi and Luke Skywalker, and Luke and Obi-Wan, they've gone out, and Han's still there, but a bounty hunter by the name of Greedo stops him cold in his tracks. They have a little exchange, and in the revised, the enhanced, digitally enhanced movies that came out in the 2000s or whenever it was, Greedo tries to shoot Han, misses, and Han shoots him and kills him. That was kind of the revisionist version of the Star Wars lore, because purists know Han shot first. Greedo doesn't get a shot off. Han shoots him and goes on his way. And that's kind of what it's like with the president. He has the unfortunate truth that must confront him that the Muslim shot first. Just like Han shot first, the Muslim shot first. It was a religion born in the rugged wilderness, forced to go forth conquering and to conquer, forced to fight for its existence. Muhammad, yes, I've mentioned it before, he started a religion that was benign, that had taken the good parts of Christianity, like meekness and gentleness and those sorts of things. He began by trying to win converts through argumentation and by persuasion, but his success was limited. until Islam became the religion of the sword, which it is even today. And they went out conquering. They conquered Jerusalem in 638. They occupied it for centuries, lived in relative peace with those around them, until the Seljuk Turks, the ISIS of their day, came and slaughtered, well, began to persecute Christians, and then they slaughtered about 12,000 of them 2 miles outside of Jerusalem. Christians who were trying to peaceably make their way on a pilgrimage to Jerusalem. It wasn't happening with the Seljuk Turks. And that was the massacre which started the Crusades, or at least shocked the world into the Crusades. And Urban did his thing, promising the people material gain as well as spiritual rewards. Deus vult, shout the crowds. And then the Crusades are born. The crusading spirit begins, and for two centuries, that's what takes over. And again, I've rehearsed all this history in the previous episodes. Go back and listen to them for more detailed information. But here's the deal. What were some of the causes and consequences of the Crusades? And that's really what I'm after in this episode. What were the causes of the Crusades? What were the purposes of the Crusades? And number one, absolutely, yeah, the Crusaders went out to defeat the Muslims. I mean, they had taken over the Holy Lands. That was our territory. That's where Jesus walked. So let's go take it back. But also, the Muslims, by the way, weren't just peaceably sitting around, minding their own business, peace-loving, reading the Quran, thinking deeply about Allah and how peaceable Islam is, and then the mean old Christians came riding in, conquering and conquering, all that. So that's fantasy. That's the Obama history revisionist fantasy in his mind. No, the Muslims were busily exercising the principles of Quran. They were fighting one another. The Seljuk Turks, they were Muslims, and they were coming against their Muslim brothers in Jerusalem and taking territory from them. They were persecuting one another, and yes, they were also persecuting the Christians. Oh, but by the way, that's not the history that we like. It's not conducive to the politically correct anti-Christian atmosphere that so many people are trying to push today. 12,000 Christian pilgrims were slaughtered outside of Jerusalem by Muslims, the Seljuk Turks, the ISIS of their day, merely living out the principles of the Quran. Why was it that Charles Martel has to drive back an invading horde of Muslims in 732 out of France? It's because they were conquering. That's what they do. It's the religion of the sword. Go forth and conquer. So yeah, there was, yeah, we're going to defeat the Muslims. They were threatening Constantinople, threatening to take over the Byzantine Empire. In fact, that was another cause of the Crusades. They want to save the Byzantine Empire. That's the Eastern Empire, and the Eastern Emperor, Alexis I, he's the one who sends the missive all over the Western Empire. But one of those letters happens to be sent to a guy named Pope Urban II, and, well, the rest is history. So, yeah, defeat the Muslims, save the Byzantine Empire. They also, there was this idea by the Pope to reunite Eastern and Western churches, the Eastern Orthodox as well as the Roman Catholic Church, to bring them back. And listen, this goes back. I mean, this was years of animosity, which the formal event which marked the final schism was in 1054 when Cardinal Humbert marches into the Cathedral of Sophia, lays down a papal bull of excommunication on Michael Cerularis, the patriarch of the Eastern Church, and says, you're excommunicated, and anyone else who follows you is excommunicated, with all kinds of theatricality and drama, marches out, shakes the dust off his shoes, and keeps on walking. And ever since, there's been this divide. Pope Gregory, the 5th or 6th or something, one of those, he, during that time, had this vision of a grand Western army which would help to unite Eastern and Western branches of the church. But in his time, he couldn't do it. The time wasn't right in the middle of the 11th century. But at the end of the 11th century, with Pope Urban II and the threat of Islam on the rise, marching onto the Byzantine Empire and Constantinople, now was the perfect opportunity. And for a time, yeah, the two branches were united, at least against a common enemy, the invading Muslims. But it really didn't last. In fact, none of these results achieved much. None of these purposes were really achieved permanently, including reconquering the Holy Lands. Yeah, it's our territory. That's where Jesus walked. Now, this is my opinion. This is purely speculation. I don't know for sure. But I am persuaded that one of the reasons that God, in his wisdom, allowed the Muslims to take Jerusalem in 638 in the first place was a declaration to everyone that he doesn't live there. Granted, he'd already twice driven Christians out, if you want to put it that way, to the ends of the earth. Go fulfill your mission. What are you doing staying around here? Acts chapter 8, under the persecution of Saul of Tarsus, everyone, all the Christians, they are exploded out of Jerusalem, and they go everywhere preaching the word. Everyone except for the apostles stay there. But then in 70 AD, when the Roman army comes marching on Jerusalem and completely destroys the town, including the temple, that is a declaration, fulfillment of prophecy at the lips of Jesus. That is a declaration from heaven saying, I don't live here. I live in a new temple, which is the bodies of people. He lives in those Christians who have been obedient to the gospel. He's taken up residence there. We receive the Holy Spirit, which is the abiding presence of God when we are obedient to the gospel. Acts 2:38, 1 Corinthians 3, verse 16, also verse 17, 1 Corinthians 6, verses 19 and 20. And so twice, and now the third time in 638, the Muslims come, taking it over, raise it to the ground. That's three times God has said, I don't live here anymore. Go out and convert the world. You would think that they would get it, but nobody was thinking this way during the 11th century. They were thinking, let's go take it back. It's our land. And all the while, you know, it's also connected to this idea that it's related to why I believe we do not have the original New Testament autographs. We have manuscript copies of those autographs, and we can reconstitute the New Testament to, what is it, something like 99%, and the few pieces that we argue over are letters and that sort of thing. But God knows who we are. He knows our nature. He knows our inclination to worship the thing, the documents that tell us about God rather than the God of the documents. You see what I'm saying? He knows that we would venerate them and make them into relics and worship those rather than the God that the documents tell us about. And so in a similar way, God, knowing man's inclination to venerate stuff and turn relics, even during the Crusades, there was the story about how they thought they found the Holy Lance that had pierced the side of Jesus in Antioch. But that's man's inclination. And so I believe it was God saying, not only do I not live here, but I don't want you coming back here and trying to make relics. But they didn't get the message. They wanted to go back and retake it. It's our land. It's our place. And so those are the causes of the Crusades. And yes, there is a religious tinge here, but the overarching purpose behind all of this was land and money and food and power. And Pope Urban II, above all, he was saying, yeah, you'll win heaven, but you got to take this holy pilgrimage to Jerusalem and retake it. And so those are the purposes. Let's talk quickly about the consequences of the Crusades, because there are a number of consequences. First, I believe it was Gonzalez who talks about the mistrust and enmity between Christians and Muslims. But really, I think that's more of a one-way street. Muslims still hold a grudge over the Crusades. This is over a millennium ago. About a millennium ago, when the Crusades took place. And they still, when our troops are over there, our American troops are over in the Middle East, they call them Crusaders. There's a fundamental misunderstanding here, or at least I shouldn't put it that way. They carry that grudge over, and so there's this continued enmity. We in the West, we don't have as long a memory. We don't even remember who won the Super Bowl 3 years ago. Muslims, though, they continue to hold this grudge. There's this continual enmity between Muslims toward Christians. And maybe if you're over there as a Christian, Maybe you have some enmity. I don't know. But, yeah, there does seem to be this continued mistrust. That was part of it. But it's not just because the mean old wascally Christians came in trying to... No, there was violence on both sides. What, you think when the Muslims started taking over giant swaths of land, it was a bloodless, nonviolent affair? I call foul. And in fact, Washington Irving, in his book, The Life of Muhammad, he talks about some of the battles. And in one of the battles, you know what they did to one of the leaders of the armies that came against them? They cut his head off. Does that sound familiar? Yeah. More things change, the more they stay the same. Another consequence, both Gonzalez and Bruce Shelley in his book, they talk about this, the enhanced power of the papacy. In fact, the papacy, the pope, he becomes the most powerful man during the Crusades. The papacy reaches its zenith of power, the apex of power, under Innocent III, who is the one who's leading the disastrous Fourth Crusade, which doesn't accomplish very much of anything. Yeah, the enhanced power of the Pope. That was a big one. He got a lot of power. After the Crusades and into the High Middle Ages, it really does devolve into kind of a joke. You got a lot of nepotism, a lot of immorality, a lot of sexual stuff. And in fact, at one point, there's like three popes, two in Rome or one in France or something like that. It's a joke after this. But in the meantime, during the Crusades, a lot of power to the Pope. Urban, Innocent III, they're the guys who do that. Now, here's another consequence of the Crusade, which really goes back earlier than this. It's the intellectual revitalization and the rise of scholasticism. What I mean is, there was a time long before the Crusades, and even long before Muhammad, when some of the Eastern philosophers made their way over to Rome and Greece. They were exposed to Aristotelian philosophy and translated his work from Greek into Arabic, took it back with them, and so they had that going on. That was their particular bent. They really liked Aristotle. Over in the West, they really clung to Plato. And you had the rise of Platonism, Neoplatonism, and that sort of stuff. And that's really what the early Christian church latched onto, was that kind of thinking. Well, with the spread of the Muslim armies, and with the spread even of the rise of Muslim intellectualism, what I mean is, when they went conquering, they conquered Alexandria. Alexandria had a pretty substantial library there. And so all the Muslim scientists, the doctors, astronomers, all the Muslim thinkers, philosophers, theologians, they all converged there, and they were reintroduced to some of the Western thinking. And for a while, Muslim medicine and science and mathematics and philosophy was second to none. It's unfortunate that they kind of stagnated after this, but... In the meantime, yeah, there was a lot of this going on. Well, they preserved the writings of Aristotle in Arabic, and even towards the end of the Crusades and after the Crusades, the writings of Aristotle were reintroduced, if you want to say it that way, to the Western world through mostly the theologians and philosophers of the day. And so Aristotle's work, they were preserved, and they were once more introduced. And so guys like Peter Abelard, he takes the works of Aristotle and tries to, unsuccessfully, wed them to Catholic theology. It actually is up to a guy named Thomas Aquinas. Ever hear of this guy? Smart, smart cat. He's the one who's finally able to wed Aristotelian philosophy with Catholic theology, and you end up with a very nice blending of the faith with reason and logic and those sorts of things. Aquinas wasn't an Aristotelian guy. I mean, he wasn't a fan of everything Aristotle, but he had a lot of it. And that thread continues through into the Reformation, although initially guys like Luther and Calvin, they kind of are anti-Aristotle, anti-reason. They're all about faith, and they're fighting the Catholic Church, which their guy was Thomas Aquinas. And so So there was a lot of that, but it does reemerge later on in the Reformation and even on down through the Restoration. That's why we're so logical and reason-oriented. Guys like John Locke, who latched on to philosophy and things like that, we come through that lineage of reason and thinking and carry it with us. And it comes back to the Crusades. When in fact, one writer talked about how that's probably the most significant contribution of the Crusades is intellectual revitalization and the rise of scholasticism. Granted, for a little while there, because of the Black Plague, which wipes out a good portion of the European population, it kind of takes a back seat, but it's primed and ready for the Renaissance, which is coming down the pike, 15th, 16th century, something like that. So yeah, that's a big consequence. And then there's one more consequence. Deus Vult. God wills it. That was the cry of the people. They truly believed this was God's will, especially because they had the Pope, who was really jamming this thing down, really driving this bus, and he's the vicar of Christ, he's the head of the church, he's the one who's leading the whole religious thing, even though he'd become more of a statesman. Yeah, God must will it. It must be God's will for us to go back, even though Acts 8, even though 70 AD, even though the Muslims took it over in 638, maybe God's sending a message there, but you know what? God wills it. Let's go take it back. And it might have seemed like for a little while that, yeah, this must be God's will because we've had some success. The First Crusade, which is the most successful crusade, they're actually able to take back Jerusalem. But less than a century later, God wills it. A guy by the name of Saladin, he comes on the scene and he retakes Jerusalem. And drives the crusaders out. Yeah, God wills it. Which makes you wonder about the Christian perspective and war. Can Christians, should Christians advocate war? Ooh, that's a good question, isn't it? That could be a question of the day.
And now it's time for the question of the day. Question of the day. Question. This is the question of the day on Life from the Pulpit.
Is it God's will for Christians to go to war? Should Christians be pro-war? This is a question that I have been wrestling with for a couple of weeks now, and it comes to the forefront, especially now, because of President Obama requesting from Congress some kind of war power. And I know he said what it isn't, but it is what it is. He's asking for some kind of ability to wage some kind of offensive against Islam, ISIS. Forgive me. It's Islamic State, but anyway. So yeah, what should be the Christian's perspective? Now, here's the thing. Most Christians would probably advocate maybe a pacifistic position. And I think that's fair because you're going to quote Scripture to me. Not the least of which, Matthew chapter 5, the Sermon on the Mount. Do not resist an evil person. Love your enemy. Pray for those who persecute you. Jesus did say, my kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my crew would fight for me. But my kingdom's not of this world. He who lives by the sword shall die by the sword. Isn't that found on the lips of Jesus? And there are a number of other passages just like that about seemingly having a pacifistic attitude toward conflict and violence and war. Someone strikes you on the one cheek, turn him the other also. And so I can understand the pacifistic attitude. I can understand that from my brethren. But then there are others who say, well, you know, that's more of an individual thing, pacifism. You know, you want to avoid conflict as much as possible. But a realistic idea would be, yeah, for the individual, that's good. But as a nation, you know, nations, you go to war. And with some justification to, you know, appeal to Romans 13, the governments that are put in place by God, and they do not bear the sword in vain. And so, I can understand that position, Christian realist approach. But here's the struggle that I have, because I readily recognize that Jesus does say those things in the gospel. But at the same time, I have an Old Testament full of accounts of war. I mean, the Israelite army is constantly going forth into battle. And in fact, in the law, you have entire chapters, Deuteronomy 20, for example, devoted to what you do when you go to war. Deuteronomy 23 is another example where God gives regulations concerning when you go to war and how you wage war and those sorts of things. You have example after example after example of the Israelites going to war. David, man after God's own heart, is also a man of war. The Lord himself is called a man of war. Abraham, patriarch of the faith. In, what is it, Genesis 14, he goes out to war trying to take back his family. So there's war all over the Old Testament, and you might say, well, that's Old Testament. Yeah, but isn't Jesus also the one who talked about when a king goes to war, doesn't he sit down and determine if he has enough troops to go against a larger army? There in Luke 14. Isn't Jesus the one who says, if you don't have a sword, go buy one? And Peter says, oh, we've got two. He says, that's enough, you know. And then, yeah, you do have the Romans 13 thing. And you also have one of the first Christian converts among the Gentiles. He's a soldier, a centurion in the Roman army. Cornelius, Acts chapter 10. So what do we do with all this? How do we reconcile this? You have the pacifist on the one side. You've got the Christian realist on another. And then you've got me, who I've got a bunch of Bible. And I don't know what to do with some of this stuff. Because on the one hand, it does seem that God does advocate for war. But on the other hand, you've got Christ, who has all these principles laid down. Which is it? And I'm going to have to deal with this in more detail next week on the podcast and the next coming episodes about the Christian and their attitude toward war. You have a tradition in the church history, I should say, guys like Augustine, who puts forward the just war theory, the just war theology. And there are three basic principles, three basic tenets of the just war idea. That pertain to justice and how you treat non-combatants and things like that. We'll rehearse that in the coming episode. But yeah, what do we do with this? What should be the Christian's attitude? That is a good question, which again we'll have to pick up in the next episode. The bottom line is, again, God wills it. We need to be careful with that, because short of having a thus saith the Lord. In the Old Testament, they had that. Israel had, yeah, you're going to go and you're going to take the land. They had a thus saith the Lord. But as far as the Crusades, I know they thought they had one. They had the Pope. But it doesn't seem like they did. And then we today, what about us? Again, these are the questions we'll consider next time. I'm out of time. Feel free to leave a comment on the website. Always like to hear what you have to say. Search Facebook, Life from the Pulpit. Like the Facebook page. You'll get all the updates when I go live with the podcast. Update the blogger, post new video on YouTube. Speaking of YouTube, search YouTube, Life from the Pulpit. Subscribe to the YouTube channel. Question of the Day segments there for you to use in your Bible study. Follow me on Twitter, at InPulpit, at the letter N as in Nick, Pulpit, P-U-L-P-I-T. Now on iTunes, search the iTunes store, Life from the Pulpit. Download all the episodes to your particular device. You'll never be more than a click away from an episode of the podcast. Be sure and stop at the Life from the Pulpit blog. L-I-F-E from the pulpit.wordpress.com. All of my commentary there on Luke, James, 1st, 2nd, 3rd, John, now Philippians, all there, all available, all free for you to use and peruse in your everyday Bible study. Check out Merced Church of Christ website, mercedchurchofchrist.org, mercedchurchofchrist.org. Plenty of sermon audio there for you to grow as well. And as always, brethren, grace be with you all. Thanks for listening.